On this week's 51%, we learn about some of the remarkable women who blazed their own trails in New York's Adirondack Mountains and how the mountains shaped them.
She just said that she always kept Crane Mountain with her. That spirit of the Adirondacks gave her courage throughout her life.
We also learn about the various species of fish that migrate up the Hudson River with riverkeeper Tracy Brown. I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on, I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh or Lita. I wasn't really in it, I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jesse King. I don't know about you, but I love to hike in the summer. Our main guests today have been tracking women's history in a very specific and much-loved destination in New York, the Adirondack Mountains. At more than 6 million acres, the Adirondack Park is the largest park in the contiguous United States. It contains 46 high peaks, more than 100 communities, and it attracts millions of visitors looking to hike, hunt, and fish each year. When you think of Adirondack history, perhaps you think of the surveyor Verplank Colvin, resort owner Paul Smith, Representative Garrett Smith, or abolitionist John Brown, who kept a farm in the mountains. But what about the park's women? Well, more than 20 years ago, authors Sandra Weber and Peggy Lynn put together a guide on the area's most famous women called Breaking Trail, Remarkable Women of the Adirondacks. Weber is a historian who has written multiple books about the Adirondack Park. Lynn is a singer-songwriter who has performed extensively in the region. By combining Lynn's songs and Weber's research, the two tell the stories of 25 different women hikers, hunters, guides, and legends who shaped the Adirondack Park, and in some cases, the world, into what it is today. Recently, they came out with a new edition, adding even more stories, details, and reflections. I got the chance to speak with them both. Lynn says tracking women's history has always been important to her, whether in print or in song.
I always like to talk about Lydia Martin Smith because she was my first story. As I was working at Paul Smith's college and standing in the library one day talking to Neil Serpernot, who was the librarian there, and we were looking at historic photos of Paul Smith's hotel, the early days of their settlement there, and Neil was telling me about how Lydia had been educated downstate and that it was her idea to start an electric company, and it was her idea to build sawmills along the St. Regis River so that as they sold land to settlers, they could also sell the lumber for their buildings. And she did all the investment and wrote all the contracts. And she was quite a shrewd businesswoman. And I looked at him and said, why is there no portrait of her here on campus? Why don't we hear any of this? And he said, you're a songwriter, write her a song. And so that was kind of the beginning. But as I sang the song about her, as I traveled around, people came to me and said, oh, you need to also write about this woman who's from my community. And she did this marvelous all these marvelous things. So it got us started.
Yes, it was she who hired and fired the staff at the hotel. And when it came to contracts, she gave those lawyers hell. She managed the accounting and the money in the till. She even taught their growing sons until the school was built. Lydia, I want to tell you a story, Lydia, so we'll know mountain women. Can
Now, I know the book references some of Peggy's songs and your work as well. Tell me a little bit about that creative decision and how you incorporate these songs into the text.
We just included any lyrics from my songs that were written for or about those women. I had to be convinced that they were they were relevant. So Sandy said to me, she said, well, what if you saw that Dan Berggren, a songwriter friend of mine, had written a book and had included some of his lyrics? Wouldn't you think that they were relevant? And so I said, oh, yes, I guess so.
I think including the lyrics actually adds a whole nother dimension to the book, because Peggy, in her lyrics, tells the story very succinctly, like gets right to the heart of it. And she doesn't have to be 100% historically correct, because it's a folk song after all. And so she can get right to it. And I was thinking today about how some of the lyrics, like "Mountain Women Can Be Heroes" from the Lydia song, that just says it right there. Or from the Esther song, "Be Brave and Follow Your Dream." So I think the lyrics add a whole nother dimension to the history.
Well, Sandra, do you have a favorite woman or a story that you'd like to share with us?
One of my favorite women is Inez Milholland.
Oh, yes. She's the famous suffragist.
Yes. And I'm very familiar with her because I live in Elizabethtown, right on the border with Lewis. And she spent a lot of time in Lewis at her family estate, Meadowmount, which is now the Meadowmount School of Music. And her family were settlers here very early. Her father was born in the town of Lewis. And so Inez's grave is just 3 or 4 miles up the road from my house. And so I became very, very interested in her. Not many people knew that, like, here we had this most famous suffragist of the era, practically. And she's right here in the Adirondacks, and she's buried here in the Adirondacks. And she probably learned to ride horses here in the Adirondacks at the farm. And of course, she's famous for riding the big white horse, dressed all in white, at the head of the 1913 suffrage parade in Washington, D.C. And she really became the emblem of the women's movement for the National Women's Party. And she campaigned in 1916 against Woodrow Wilson for president because he wouldn't support women's suffrage. And so she went on this long train trip across the country, stopping at towns along the way, and finally made it out to California. And she was just simply exhausted, and she collapsed on stage. And the last thing she said is, "Mr. President, how long must women wait for liberty?" And she was taken to the hospital. She had blood transfusions and such, and she died 3 weeks later at the age of 30. And she was brought to the Lewis Cemetery here and buried on the top of the hill. And I've held many, many celebrations around her grave, and it's really become quite a rallying spot for women.
That's really cool. I didn't know that she was buried up there. Was she born, or did she grow up in the Adirondacks?
She was not born there. Her father was born there. They had moved to New York City by then, you know, but she came summers and holidays and everything, and spent that at Meadowmount, and, you know, did suffrage speeches and everything in Elizabethtown, Plattsburgh, around the whole area. And so I'm not sure exactly which year it became official, 2021, that a little mountain next to Meadowmount, her father had always wanted to call Mount Inez, and it became official in 2021. And there's a picture on the back of the new book of Peggy and I on the top of Mount Inez.
Very sweaty. It was a very hot day.
Well, I'd like to talk about Esther, because she also has a mountain named after her. Hers was the first mountain in the range to be named after a woman, or a girl in this case, right?
Yes, that's correct. That was my first book. That was the first woman that I really researched. That's what changed my life, was Esther. And I went in search of who was this Esther, this 15-year-old girl who was trying to climb Whiteface, and she got lost and she ended up on this other peak next to Whiteface. And her family got all worried about her, didn't know where she was, and they all came out to find her the next day. And when they found her, they're like, "Oh, you were so brave. We're so proud of you. We should name that peak in your honor." And I couldn't actually find an Esther Coombs. Sometimes she's called McCombs, but I believe the name was Coombs because there was a family with that name that lived in the region. Just not quite in 1839, I don't think. But as usual, it's very difficult to find women in 1839 because they weren't listed in the census. So I did a lot of walking around a lot of cemeteries looking for someone named Esther, but I didn't find Esther Coombs, but I believe she existed.
Well, that kind of goes into one of my next questions, actually. When putting this book together, what kind of archives and records did you have to research? It sounds like, what you said, women weren't on the census for a very long time, so sounds like it was pretty boots on the ground.
Absolutely, especially back when we first wrote this book, the internet wasn't really there with all those ancestry resources and tax records online. Things just weren't online at that point. You had to go to the county clerk's office, to the local library, to the historian, historical society. And Peggy, you did a lot of interviewing. Why don't you talk a little about that?
I did go to a lot of little towns in the Adirondacks, down to Old Forge and Inlet and Piseco, of all places, and interviewed the children, grandchildren, people in the communities of these women. One of the best conversations I had was outside of Speculator. I interviewed three of Julia Burton Preston's grandchildren. She was reputed to be the first woman licensed guide in New York State. And she and her husband guided people in the Piseco area. It was probably 1950s, maybe. They would paddle them to good fishing spots, and they often had a deer antler that they would take and smack on the fish on the head, and then the guide would do all the really hard work, and they would take the tenderfeet out hunting and kind of hold the deer by the tail so that the Flatlanders could shoot it. Took them up mountains if that was what they wanted to do, any kind of guiding they wanted, but often then they would take them back to their own house and feed them and put them up and all of that kind of work as well. And she was legendary. They told me that Julia drove a school bus in her later years, and she would, stop to show the children any kind of wildlife they came across. And she kept a rifle underneath the driver's seat of the bus and would turn around after they were at school and go back and see what she could shoot. And I said to them, after, them telling, regaling me with all these stories, I said, "Well, I'm writing a book, so I'm wondering how much of this I can include." And they said, "You might as well put it all in because everybody in town knows she did all that."
Well, were there any other stories that surprised you doing this book?
I was surprised, I guess, by Jean Robert Foster's story. She grew up near Johnsburg. She grew up very, very poor. Her family was so poor that she had to go and live with different relatives and friends, in order for them to feed her, kind of, and boarding. And she grew up that poor, and she's had a speech impediment, it turns out, as young. And some people actually called her homely as a young girl. And she grew up to become a model and a poet. She ended up on the cover of Cosmopolitan magazine. And what is it? The Harrison Fisher girl of 1904. And she ends up going to Europe and meeting John Butler Yeats and all these famous writers and poets and things. And she comes back to this country and she studies writing and such. And she ends up writing these marvelous poems about her youth in the Adirondacks and these wonderful, quirky, common people that she meets. And it, to me, it's just such a story of how the Adirondacks became a part of her, and especially Crane Mountain. She loved Crane Mountain. She would guide people to Crane Mountain. And she had a special place out there where the rock wall just went straight up, and she called it her favorite trysting spot. And she would charge tourists 25 cents to take them out there to her special spot in the woods. And she just said that she always kept Crane Mountain with her. That spirit of the Adirondacks gave her courage throughout her life. And I think that's just such a marvelous, marvelous thing. And yes, I have to quote one of her poems. She said, "Do not say she was beautiful or kind or good. Say there was an April song once she heard and understood."
I like that. How did she get out of that childhood and find herself modeling and seeing more of the world?
Let me see. She was 18 and she married, how old was he? 45 or something?
Yes.
And he took her to New York City where he lived. And his brother was an editor for Vanity Fair magazine. And he saw Jean at dinner one night and just said, "You have to pose for me." And that started the whole story of where she ended up.
She also talked about leaning on the rocks of Crane Mountain and drawing her strength from them. And I think that inspired both of us when we have gone through difficult times to, you know, draw that strength from the mountains.
You know, on that note, you know, this isn't an easy area or environment to live in, especially when you're talking about some of those very early settlements. What was it like to live in the Adirondacks during those times?
I think Mother Johnson is the greatest example of that.
Yes, she was a camp cook, you know, and she became famous for her pancakes. She said, "I never met an empty stomach that I couldn't fill." And so I think she kept a sense of humor about her with all of this work that she had to do. I think another woman that I think of is Mary Brown, the wife of John Brown, the abolitionist. And Mary was very much an abolitionist too, but she was the one who was here in North Elba, living, managing the farm, taking care of everything while John was away a lot of the time. You know, she's birthing babies, making bread, shearing the sheep, right? Spinning the wool from the sheep to make their clothes. $10 was an enormous amount of cash for them. Because they didn't have cash. They made everything they had pretty much. So except for a few supplies, they were doing everything, you know, and they were doing the farming, plowing the field. Well, first they had to cut down the trees, right? Then they had to clear the fields, and then they, you know, had to plow it, et cetera. They, you know, had oxen to do a lot of the work.
She had to borrow money to pay the taxes from, borrow money from the neighbors so she could pay the taxes because they didn't have the cash.
Yeah, it was even better than that, actually. It was that she had put the money aside for the taxes, but then she had loaned it to a Black woman, a neighbor who needed money. And so she didn't have enough money to pay the taxes, but somehow a gift came in right at that time, so she was able to pay them. They were so poor themselves, but yet they were still giving everything they had to anybody else who needed things. It was just amazingly compassionate, generous people.
Well, Peggy and Sandra, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me. What do you hope readers most take away from Breaking Trail?
I hope they will look around their own communities and find new appreciation for the women who are founding organizations and leading political parties or whatever they're doing, and write about them. Write down their stories.
I also think on a very personal level, hearing of the struggles of these women and to know that, you know, you're not alone in struggling. It's okay to struggle. It's okay to make mistakes, but that things can get better and you can keep persisting, keep trying. That's what I take from each of these women. Really gives me the courage to do more and to do better.
Sandra Weber and Peggy Lynn are the authors of Breaking Trail, Remarkable Women of the Adirondacks. It's out now through Purple Mountain Press. You can learn more about the book and their work at nysbooks.com.
Esther grew up close to Whiteface Mountain. Thought she heard it calling her name. Her family told her, ladies, don't go climbing. Esther thought she'd try it just the same. One morning just before the dawn was breaking, Esther loaded up her brother's pack. She left behind her petticoats and ribbons. Esther wouldn't let them hold her back. Sometimes you have to climb.
A few hours south in New York's Hudson Valley, the environmental organization Riverkeeper is holding a fish migration celebration, launching a flotilla of decorated boats up the Hudson River to teach people about the various species of fish that call the Hudson home. Fishing plays a big role in Hudson River history, and unfortunately, so does pollution. Riverkeeper Tracy Brown, who has led the organization as its first woman president since 2021, says the river has come a long way since, say, the 1970s or so, but there's still a lot of cleanup to be done and new threats to look out for. Through it all, she says these species of fish make the Herculean effort to migrate between the Hudson River and the Atlantic each year.
Every spring, there is this Serengeti-scale migration of fish through our communities from the Atlantic Ocean up the Hudson River into the feeder streams and creeks within our watershed. And people aren't that aware of the scale and diversity that's happening. So we want to make that visible and give people an opportunity to get to know the fish and celebrate the fish. And of course, with the goal of then being better stewards.
Are they all migrating in the same direction, or is there some variation?
There is variation. So generally, the migratory season kind of runs from February through June, with some fish being on the earlier side, some on the later side. And most of the fish are fish that have been born and were babies within the Hudson River system, have gone out to the Atlantic Ocean, become adults, and are now coming back to spawn. But there are some exceptions, most famously the American eel, which actually is spawned out in the Sargasso Sea, which is roughly around where the Bermuda Triangle is. And they spawn in deep water there, and baby, little tiny baby, they're actually see-through eels, they call them glass eels, swim from their birthplace in the sea up into rivers and streams. And then they stay rivers and creeks within the Hudson River and other big estuary river systems. And they live their adult lives here. They can live in our communities, you know, anywhere from 5 to 20 years. And then they return when it's time to reproduce. They go back out to the Sargasso Sea.
Okay, so tell me a little bit more about some of the other species that you're celebrating here as well. We've got the American eel, and what else?
Well, of course, we have the very beloved striped bass, also associated with the Hudson and a beloved for fisher people. And then also iconic, the Atlantic sturgeon. So the Atlantic sturgeon are one of two types of sturgeon we have in the Hudson. The Atlantic sturgeon is the migrating one that goes out to the ocean. And then the short-nosed sturgeon lives its whole life within the Hudson River system. So we're celebrating the sturgeon who are endangered, the Atlantic sturgeon, American shad, another famous fish and the inspiration for shad fests back in the day when they were very abundant and their arrival triggered all kinds of feasts. And then finally, the river herring, a more modest fish. River herrings are alewives or bluebacks are two of the common local forms, but they are important and historically a part of our local ecosystem.
Fishing, I know, is a very big part of the Hudson River's history. But what are some other ways in which these species of fish factor into the Hudson Valley's history and its overall ecosystem?
Yeah, so in addition to being eaten, they also, have biological contributions like the moving of nutrients. So the Hudson River is an estuary, so it's in between the ocean, the salt water coming in tidally, and then the fresh water coming out of the river that flows out of Mount Marcy in the Adirondacks. And then in the middle, in the lower part of the river, it's what we call brackish. It's a mix. So you have this transfer of a freshwater system, a saltwater system, and then you also have all of the nutrients coming off the landscape when it rains, which we would consider our watershed. We have a 13,400 square mile watershed that also feeds into the Hudson River estuary. So nutrients and all kinds of kind of natural resources are moving in and out of the Hudson, and it's very that exchange, it really defines the river and also is a major contributor of life and resources to the whole northeastern seaboard.
You mentioned earlier that the Atlantic sturgeon is endangered. What's sort of the state of these fish overall in the Hudson right now?
Yeah, so I will say, I mean, sadly, they're all at risk, and we've seen, a decline in the quantity of life in the river, since the Industrial Revolution and just the heavy polluting of the Hudson. We also are seeing a lot of impacts and decline in marine life because of dams that are keeping the fish from getting into their spawning grounds in the first place. So all of the fish are low. I would say, of that list, the Atlantic sturgeon are the ones on the endangered species list. Also threatened in terms of, viable life are the shad. All the fish are under stress. And on top of the time we're coming out of now with really unchecked pollution, we hope we're coming out of, but we might be about to slide back into. But then you also have the impacts of the changing climate, warming of the river. Is having a lot of knock-on effects that are problematic for the fish.
Well, how can we better take care of the fish? How can we be better stewards of, I guess, their environment?
Well, don't pollute in the Hudson. Work on the marine debris. We have a big event every year called the Hudson River Sweep, where we bring people out and pull the marine debris off of our riverbank. So that's something to volunteer for. That's in May every year. Right now, we have a petition where we're calling for the hydro dams in the region to get eel screens and eel ladders. Because, as I mentioned, these tiny little baby eels go up into riverways and then they try to come back to spawn, and they're much larger, up to 4 feet long adult eels. And if they have to go through a turbine, they're getting killed and chopped up. So that's one of the things we're working on. Also, dam removal. If you have a dam on your property and you're interested in having your dam removed, please reach out to Riverkeeper. We have a whole team that is dedicated to getting rid of these abandoned dams. A lot of them are abandoned mill dams or just kind of recreational dams for ponds that people realize would be better as connective riverways. Those are just a handful. There's so much to do, but I'd say in general, just the most important thing is, the river is a mirror reflecting back to our communities on the riverbanks, how we're living. So if you go down to the river and you see or smell pollution, then you have to go back to your community and say, what are we doing and how can we be better stewards?
Tracy Brown is the president of the environmental organization Riverkeeper, advocating for the Hudson River in New York. You can learn more about their work at riverkeeper.org. Thanks for listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio based in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at our website, wamcpodcast.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can stay in the loop on all of WAMC's shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King, 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half. He was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. At night and down the hallway, I had to learn how to look away. I lost my cool.